Well, hello and welcome to this week's A Photographic Life. Seems to me that photography in the 90s seems to be having a hot moment. I noticed that there is a seminar day at the Martin Parr Foundation in Bristol coming up, and that features talks with Vinka Peterson, who's also contributed to this podcast, Stephen Gill, Jürgen Teller, Joy Gregory, and an old teaching colleague of mine, Richard Billingham. It's interesting, isn't it, that time sort of refocuses where photography once was. It seems to be that we're far enough away from the 90s now to give it a sort of a nostalgic tint. Two photographers who were very much part of that decade, James Dimmock and Jake Chesham. Jake, a very good friend of mine, first person I ever gave a commission to, actually. We were both at St. Martin's at the same time, studying graphics. Jake was the year below me, with another photographer you may have heard of called Platon. Anyway, James and Jake have written this on the website they've set up, which is called the Farringdon Print Shop. That's farringdonprintshop.com. I really recommend checking it out. But they wrote this, and I thought it was very nostalgic and very relevant. It all began way back in the 90s. We were just starting out when we met on the street outside a photo studio in East London. The square mile around Farringdon in London EC1 was our realm. The area was teeming with photo studios, labs and darkrooms, magazine offices and greasy spoon cafes and not much else. It was the glory days of magazines, and we were part of a cluster of young, wide-eyed photographers who would huddle over cups of tea, chatting and waiting anxiously for the lab to process the film from our latest test shoot or editorial for the face or ID. We'd beg, steal and borrow to get a commission for the hip new magazine, meet a cool art director, get a deal on a studio and still have the money for the tube fare home. Flash forward many years, and we reconnected in the US where we had both moved. We began to share stories, mull over old negs and contact sheets, talk about the shoots we did then and those we are doing now. And we decided to set up an online gallery as a way to make images from our archive available to buy. I applaud Jake and James for getting together and making this thing happen. There's so many times that I talk with photographers questioning me as to what to do with their archive. I think they're both lucky in that what they managed to do in the 90s was photograph so many celebrities, iconic faces and people, actors and actresses, musicians, who were at the beginning of their careers, and therefore their photographs have a saleability attached to them. That obviously helps when it comes to selling prints, but I'm not going to say that it's easy, but I do think it's a really great initiative. But with this hot moment around the 90s coming to fruition, it's happening, in music, I think. People are now looking back to the 90s in clothes and so forth. And certainly in the book, which I've got coming out in a few weeks' time, the Inside Vogue book, when I was writing that, I really thought that I would be writing about the 1960s as being the decade of creativity and excitement in London. However, when I started to write about the 90s and my particular involvement with it, I started to realise that was one hell of a decade. Whilst we're talking about archives, as I've been saying over the last few weeks, I've been tidying up, sorting things out for moving house. And I keep finding things that I didn't realise that I still had, and thinking that perhaps at the time when I stored them away in a drawer in a box, I thought that they were important. Now I look at them and I can't understand why I thought they were important or what importance they should have. But perhaps as photographers, as collectors, as visual people, we feel that need to collect ephemera, little bits and pieces from our careers that maybe did mean something to us. But will they in the future, as I said? I'm really not sure. Now, I am somebody who's very good at throwing things away. That's obviously to my detriment, because quite often I look back and think, oh, I wish I still had that. But I've been going through the process again, and I don't feel any emotional attachment to these items. That's something I often talk to photographers about also, when it comes to editing their work and choosing the images which they're going to show, or they're going to put on their website, or that's going to go into a book. The emotional attachment to an image, to an artifact, can really sway the judgment of its true quality. What we've got to try and do, I believe, is always stay objective. So objectively, recently, I've been throwing an awful lot of stuff away. This week, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the podcast to explain to us what photography means to him in under 5 minutes, Michael Robinson Chavez, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who became seduced by photography after a friend gave him a camera to take on a trip to Peru. A native Californian who is half Peruvian, Robinson Chavez is now based in the Washington, D.C. region. He worked for the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and Associated Press before working as a staff photographer for 15 years at the Washington Post. He has covered assignments in over 75 countries, including the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the collapse of Venezuela, violence in Mexico, California's historic drought, the Egyptian Revolution, gold mining in Peru, climate change in Siberia, life in Brazil's favelas, and the US-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. Robinson Chavez was named an Eyewitness Fellow. He is a frequent lecturer and has taught photographic workshops with the Leica Academy and Foundry, amongst others, in over 20 countries. I'm really looking forward to listening and hearing Michael Robinson Chavez.
Hello, my name is Michael Robinson Chavez, and I am a visual journalist currently based in Annapolis, Maryland, but by this summer will be living with my family in Valencia, Spain, so making the cross-Atlantic journey, which we are very much looking forward to. Thank you, Grant, for having me on and posing a question that I honestly don't recall ever being asked before, and that is, what does photography mean to me? Well, I guess it's meant a lot of different things to me, and I guess I have to go back to the beginning when I first decided that photography was something I really loved and wanted to pursue. I kind of grew to love it out of other experiences. In high school, I grew up in Southern California. I was doing a lot of surfing, playing drums, not attending class, much to my mother's dismay. But a friend of mine gave me a camera on a trip to Peru. My mom is from Peru, from Lima. And this was in 1989, and Peru was going through some tumultuous times. There was a civil war raging in the Andes and descending upon Lima. The currency was in free fall. It had the value of confetti for the most part. And it was in complete disarray. And it was into this environment that I went in 1989. And it was very seductive. And it was hard to make sense of. I mean, I grew up in a fairly bucolic suburb of Los Angeles, and to be thrust into the chaos of Lima at that time was a bit overwhelming. And one thing that helped with this camera that I was given is that it allowed me to put some order into this world that I was witnessing. And I indeed had already fallen in love with travel on a previous Peru trip the year prior. And now with the camera, it kind of gave me a way to compartmentalize what I was seeing, what I was experiencing. And so that's what I did with it. And it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it. And I loved photography. I loved, you know, working in the dark room. My mother was very relieved when I decided to make photography a career. And at first I was very much into surf photography and water photography, but my brother was attending classes in San Francisco State University on journalism. And I started to look at the work of Magnum photographers and you know, Cartier-Bresson and Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange and so many great photographers, and really fell in love with photographing, with the photograph as document, right? As journalism, as information blended with art, just to bridge those two worlds. And so photography meant that for me. It was storytelling. Everyone loves to hear a good story, and everyone loves to see a good story. And having been a cinephile all my life, I really wanted to put stories together, but without the massive collaborative effort that's necessary when you're doing motion pictures, even documentary film, you know, it's quite a collaborative process. And I enjoyed the solitary experience of being out and finding these stories by myself and documenting them and essentially having kind of the final cut in some ways, of course, until you get to see your editors and they have different thoughts than what you did initially. But it was the ability to educate people. I've worked at a number of newspapers. The last one I worked for was the Washington Post. And there I knew that that online and in the printed page, that influential people were seeing this, that the stories that were coming out were reaching an audience that could actually do something, or even better, you could drive normal readers, typical readers, to do something based on the stories you were bringing home, whether it was something about people enduring climate change, conflict zones. I covered conflict for many, many years in the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa, Europe, and you know, to bring the readers there. I mean, that was our responsibility as photojournalists, as visual journalists. And to document that, that's kind of the main meaning for me, was that I can get these pictures in front of people, and if I can't drive them to action, because that's asking a lot, right? But at least to educate them as to what's going on out there. Now it's a deluge of information, but I'm hoping that with, you know, good, strong storytelling, that deep meaning of photography will still translate to people who are out there and willing to look at it, learn from it, and hopefully do something about it. So thank you again, Grant, for having me on. And I still love photography now that I no longer work for the Washington Post, and I'm embarking on a freelance career in Europe. I kind of have some new fire and new ideas about how to make photography even more potent and kind of change up the way I do things.
Thank you, Michael, for your contribution this week. So much to unpack there. Wish you a lot of luck moving to Valencia. I have to say, one of, if not my favorite city in Spain. Just small, but big enough, really beautiful, fantastic restaurants, foods and bars. Anyway, I can't go on too much about that, but I'm sure you're going to enjoy that move. From a photographic perspective, for me, Michael's hitting so many points of relevance in the understanding of the photographic medium and its connection with storytelling. This is something that I've been talking a lot with people about over the last few weeks, and actually trying to identify where the world of publishing is going. And I think that what Michael's doing and what Michael is saying is exactly where it's going. So I hope if you're listening to this and you're a little bit confused perhaps around this idea as photographer, as storyteller, as passer on of information, that his clarity there brings some clarity to you also. His work, as you would expect, is incredibly powerful and incredibly important, I believe. So do make sure you check out his website. It was nice recently to receive an email from one of our listeners saying how good you think the audio is on this podcast. I have to say last week's was a bit of a challenge because I was moving into a new space and I wasn't quite sure how I was going to get the acoustics to work. I don't know any post-production on this podcast. It literally takes me as long as it takes you to hear it. That's how long it takes me to make it. I just sit down in front of the microphone and start talking. Very little preparation. But anyway, I went online and had a look at the idea of buying a podcast kind of booth type thing. And they're only £400 or £500. So a quick trip down to B&Q, the hardware store, some polycarbonate sheeting and some audio foam board that I already had, meant that I actually have built my own little podcast studio for no more than £20. So that's what I'm using this week before we progress to the studio in the garage that I've spoken about. Don't think that's going to happen now until at least middle of May. So my homemade kit is what's going to be used. But it was really nice to get that email and asking me how did I get such good audio sound. And I had to respond to them and say, I really don't know. I spoke last week about Rick Rubin's book, A Creative Act, The Way of Being, and bearing in mind, this podcast has always traditionally been full of mistakes. I thought there was something in there, again, I would share with you as I'm making my way through the book. I've just got to the bit on openness. Anyway, he says this: sometimes the mistakes are what makes a work great. Humanity breathes in the mistakes. And that's so often the case, isn't it, with photography. We can't set out to create perfection, because in a sense, perfection, I think, is rather boring. It lacks that kind of humanity. It lacks that emotion. And yet, I see and hear so many photographers talking to me about trying to create a style, a perfect image. Well, it's a bit like trying to create a perfect podcast. I actually don't think it's achievable, certainly not for me. And I don't actually think that a perfect photograph is achievable either. I started off this week talking about the 1990s, so I thought it would be a good way to end this particular episode with a short extract from my book, Inside Vogue House, One Building, Seven Magazines, 60 Years of Stories, which is on pre-sale now through Orphans Publishing, with a little extract there from the chapter that deals with the 1990s in Vogue House in London. The 1990s were my decade in Vogue House. It was, if I am honest, a decade that I had given little credence to before starting to write. I had always had a nostalgic feeling that the 1960s were the fun years in fashion publishing, the decade when the most rules were broken and the best work was created. Now I think I was wrong, and I am not alone. In 2022, an announcement for a documentary television series to be called In Vogue, The 1990s, stated that the 90s was such an exciting and important decade for fashion. It was the period when fashion entered the mainstream, when it became inescapable, culturally relevant, and full of iconoclasm and expression and difference. The 1990s were the decade when Vogue House became fully populated, perhaps overpopulated, and when Vogue magazine found itself challenged for relevance and importance by two new titles within its building. This challenge came not in a fashion sense, but instead for controversy and personality and for newspaper headlines. There is no doubt that the 90s was the decade when Vogue House caught fire. Not literally, of course. There was even talk of the mailroom and loading bay being the centre of an illegal drug delivery service around London, and there were subsequent arrests. And this was the decade when everything was delivered to and from the building on the back of a motorbike or in a taxi. Having ridden the wave of 1980s style, culture and fashion, magazines entered the new decade as important vehicles for communication. They had become political, intellectual, stylish arbiters of what was cool. The magazine you read said a lot about the type of person you wanted to be, and maybe were. The 1990s was the decade of Cool Britannia, Tony Blair and the Spice Girls, Oasis and Blur, the YBAs and Lad Culture, and in Vogue House, a decade of high-profile editors, controversy, elastic expense accounts and high salaries with associated perks for some. Meanwhile, entry into the building and access to working on the magazines was still as politically incorrect and as abstract as it had ever been. Jobs at Vogue House were never formally advertised. They were always discovered through word of mouth. In the 1990s, the Newhouse family, owners of Condé Nast, held an estimated personal fortune of $12 billion. The result was that some of the editors could expect six-figure salaries, company cars, chauffeur-driven transportation, daily restaurant lunches and regular luxury perks from advertisers and brands keen to feature within their magazines. Some of the editors' offices were redecorated at great expense, and the building underwent a refresh with a new boardroom built and the reception moved down to the ground floor. A new crescent-shaped desk was installed, the two Peters now hidden behind its distressed gold-leaf expanse. It was definitely designed to intimidate. On either side of the reception area, two upright, uncomfortable velvet banquettes were fitted. The one on the right would become a regular seating spot at the end of the day for the diarist and playwright Alan Bennett, waiting to meet his partner who was employed on World of Interiors. The rest of the time, these were where those waiting to be seen would be lined up. Models, journalists, photographers, and those hopeful of being employed within the building. The new boardroom, where advertisers were wined, dined, and schmoozed, was decorated with iconic black and white images from Vogue's illustrious history. It was also the venue for daily drinks, which often became an essential social starter for an evening of further drinking, dining, and clubbing across the West End of London. To those outside Vogue House, the Condé Nasties could appear to be spoilt, privileged, and overpaid. But for many, the lifestyle was just on loan, and it could be withdrawn just as quickly as it was offered. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. Take care.